ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Artemis 2 has flown round the moon, and the four astronauts on board are on their way home.
Today, for all humanity, you're pushing beyond that frontier.
We're following every step of the mission in a special daily season of science fiction called Artemis Explained. Stay with us as the mission continues to unfold, with updates from me, Belinda Smith, so you know what just happened and why it matters.
Integrity, over to you.
Search for science fiction on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
After days of building tension and dramatic threats from President Donald Trump that a whole civilization will die, the US and Iran have reached a ceasefire, with America pledging to suspend strikes on Iran for 2 weeks. Anthony Albanese, speaking ahead of a visit to Singapore this week, has reiterated calls for de-escalation while acknowledging the US president's rhetoric is inappropriate. It comes after Nationals leader Matt Canavan urged the Prime Minister to make it clear he doesn't support the US president's language, as the Nationals leader prepares today to unveil a blueprint for Australia on steroids. Welcome to Politics Now. I'm Jacob Greber, back in the chair for PK, a third day in a row, my last for the week.
And I'm David Spears, in this chair across from
Jacob. Welcome. How the tables have turned. Normally I'm on your couch on a Sunday morning, and now I am asking the questions.
Should I be nervous? Yes, I think it's the answer to that. Let me have it.
Listen, here we are. It's a very serious morning. Yep. Some real bombshell developments. We've been sitting here for the last few days sweating out whenever one of these Donald Trump deadlines will come to pass. The line has kept moving. It was 48 hours, I think, 10 days ago, then it was 10 days, and now, and then the other day it was essentially 48 hours until 10 a.m. Australian Eastern Time this morning. I'd say about half an hour before that, we got news from the president that there would indeed be a ceasefire, something he calls an
11th hour deal. And look, let's be clear, I don't think there was ever any serious threat that he would wipe out an entire civilization. I mean, think about the strategic, the economic, the political consequences that would have meant for Donald Trump alone and their prospects in the midterm. So look, but the very fact that a US president would use that sort of language, and I know every day we have this, you know, Trump shock reaction, but this sort of language, you know, even though they struck this 11th hour deal, is still being criticised, including by the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, who's called it inappropriate, by Matt Canavan.
So the language is inappropriate.
That sort of language to threaten the striking of civilian infrastructure from the President of the United States, our main ally. Clearly, this is problematic for Australia and other US allies. And it's great that this 11th hour ceasefire deal has happened, and we can go through that. But
well,
that language,
the alternative, is quite unthinkable. Well, yeah. If you take it, let's take it at face value. I mean, to say you are going to obliterate for all time a civilization, there's really only one way of doing that. It's with the most extreme kind of weapon imaginable, something that's never been used since World War II. Yet he's opened that prospect by the mere use of such words.
I mean, exactly. The reason I say it was unrealistic is because, think about it, from Trump's perspective, let alone the perspective of those in the region, strategically, would this, you know, really help turn the tide of Iranian public opinion against their regime and towards the Americans? I doubt it. Economically, how would the markets react to this? What would the, you know, the Wall Street friends of Donald Trump be saying to him on the phone? Politically, you know, you saw some cracks emerging within the Republicans as well after he used this language. What would this look like come the midterms later this year? I just think on so many fronts, it was just unbelievable that he would even be talking like this.
So do you think that people misunderstood? They took it literally and they shouldn't have, because I'm sort of looking at the reaction of the financial markets in the last hour or so, 2 hours. Dramatic drop in the oil price. Equity markets are surging. Currencies are moving around in a very dramatic fashion. So they took this ultimate news of a ceasefire before the news emerged as being something that might not happen. Otherwise, those moves would have taken place. I just think, did the world take this too literally? And what does that actually mean about Donald Trump's ability to negotiate, which is always about ratcheting things up with a lot of threats, putting a lot of leverage on the table, and then at the last minute sort of being the master of a compromise and a solution. I don't know. Do you think the Iranians actually a little bit believed him?
Well, look at where we've landed. We're yet to see a ship, I think, as we record this, go through unimpeded. But they had, the Iranians have agreed to this two-week window of safe passage of ships through the Strait. I'm not sure if everybody expected that, so maybe
That's the additionality.
The pressure that built over the days and days of these sorts of threats, maybe that played a role. Maybe both sides were just looking for some sort of off-ramp here. They both had good reason to seek some sort of off-ramp here. But, you know, we shouldn't necessarily be popping all the champagne corks just yet, because we don't know what's going to happen over these 2 weeks. We don't know what's going to happen at the end of these 2 weeks. And the idea that Iran is going to give up what they've discovered, what the world has discovered, is their ability to strangle off global oil supplies like this, the leverage that they have over the global economy and over Donald Trump and over the United States is very clear for all to see. Mm-hmm. Are they really going to give that up?
And I suppose the other point, and I'll get your thoughts on this, it's obvious that a lot of damage has been done to Iran. Yeah. From a military point of view, the degrading of their weapon systems.
And their leadership.
Their leadership. There was another head, I think, of one of the intelligence services who was killed just 2 days ago, 3 days ago.
Yeah.
So the Americans and the Israelis continue to inflict a lot of pain
on
the regime.
They do. And it's still pretty unclear, I think, to a lot of us, what is going on in Iran right now. That's pretty opaque, isn't it?
Above and beyond the question of, is the regime, how resilient is it? And up until now, you'd have to say, from our very distant vantage point, as you say, no one's really been in there to verify anything. You'd have to say the regime remains intact.
Yes.
The institutions of the mullahs and the Iranian revolution have not been dismantled.
Their ability to fire off drones and missiles, still there.
It continues all day long.
Yep.
They managed to take out or down two American aircraft over the Easter long weekend, and there was a big dramatic to-do and a story about the rescue of one of those pilots.
And here's another troubling question. What about the uranium stockpiles? Are they really all so far underground, buried, and, you know, no need to worry? Or does anyone really know? Is it all there? How easily is this to be turned into some sort of dirty bomb? Or we just don't know.
There's a lot of things you don't know. We can't know. As you said, is the use of the Strait just a temporary thing, and those ships that were sort of blocked and backed up?
Does a toll or a tariff become, you know, which has been talked about, will Iran seek some sort of reparations for all the damage via a charge for each ship going through? We don't know.
It's tricky. I think it was very interesting before the ceasefire was announced. The thing that really struck me, and it's been, you see it more in the United States in some of the coverage, the real anger towards Donald Trump coming from the right or coming from conservative voices who backed him at the last US presidential election, but have since really turned on him. People like Tucker Carlson, very condemnatory of his use of an F-bomb on, you know, on a holy weekend. Also very, very cross at this threat that Trump was throwing around about obliteration.
And some other Republicans in Congress too. The idea that civilians would be attacked. What that does to the standing of the United States, the very idea that you throw this into the mix, that sort of threat.
And then you even see Nigel Farage, very strong comments in the last few hours, saying he was amazed essentially by the language and how inappropriate it was. And then here in Australia, and I'm not saying all of these figures are equivalent, but they're on the same side of politics. Here in Australia, we had Matt Canavan, the Nationals leader, this morning, also quite forcefully condemning that language and actually telling our Prime Minister to call it out.
And he got there before our Prime. And look, Anthony Albanese did. He went on Sky News a couple of hours ago and did say that this was inappropriate. He said it was extraordinary, that the potential of damage to civilian infrastructure was an extraordinary statement to make, he said. But it was some hours before that Matt Canavan was already there, where other government ministers doing the rounds of breakfast TV and radio just weren't willing to go there, were they?
No, well, they...
This awkward caution they all have when it comes to Trump, even in a moment like this when he's saying this sort of thing.
When he's saying, actually,
wiping
out... I mean, that is genocidal talk. when you're wiping out a civilization, that's actually what the word means.
Why can't government ministers?
Well, they've they've had a talking point, haven't they? That they don't comment on the daily machinations of whatever's being said.
That, you know, that holds.
You
to
sort
a
of
point.
Hide
it
behind
holds
that.
To a point, doesn't it? But seriously, when you get to this point, and even Matt Canavan can, you know, call it out for what it is.
And I think this is why Canavan's an interesting character in this, and to some extent, Andrew Hastie's been able to do this as well.
Yep.
It's actually some figures on our political right, if you like, who are able to voice real criticism of the
Trump.
US president.
Whereas now, Angus Taylor,
he's
just wrapped up a press conference in the last 10 or 15 minutes. He was asked about Trump's language. And said, "Oh, it's not language I would use."
So he's doing the same dance as the Prime Minister.
I mean, look, the PM did go a little further, to be fair. But the same dance as those other government ministers doing the rounds of media this morning in just, being so careful to tiptoe around any criticism of Trump here.
Just to stick on that point, what does that mean about Pauline Hanson? Because remember, and I'm sure you'd agree, the political contest here on the right is between One Nation and the Liberal Party and the National Party. And you've got this clear fissure now between certain members of the National Party, Canavan in particular, but Hastie as well, from the Liberal Party, willing to take her on. And it, of course, underneath that is her undying support for Donald Trump. She was in Mar-a-Lago. She's been pictured there. She's, a full-throated supporter of what Trump's up to, whereas they are prepared to go after him.
And it's
I think that's actually even more important than whatever the Prime Minister says.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think it's fascinating that, you know, Andrew Hastie in particular has taken this line of attack against Pauline Hanson. She's for Donald Trump, I'm for Australia. Mm-hmm. Trump first versus Australia first. it's an understandable line of attack from him as well. Just back on Australia and the US. Look, let's be clear. This ceasefire for 2 weeks is unquestionably good news. This is the first positive development we've had in over a month. Let's hope that this leads to serious negotiation. We've sort of touched on all the things that remain unclear about the Strait, about the uranium stockpiles, all of these things. But let's hope this leads to some end, permanent end to this war. I do wonder, though, and I'm keen for your thoughts on this, where does this leave alliances? This has really strained the relationship in a way that I don't think previous Trump scandals have. The willingness of Albanese, and to be fair, the likes of Keir Starmer, Macron, Carney, around the world, to call him out, to demand more clarity about what is going on.
To deny him
war.
Access to certain military assets.
Yeah, exactly.
The UK's done, as have, I think, the Italians. Meloni, who is, she's no left-winger. She's a conservative.
Indeed.
She's put up roadblocks. The Germans have put up roadblocks. Yeah, it's a really big deal.
I don't think it's a break point
in the
alliance, but it's a really interesting turning point.
I couldn't help but think, and I know history is not always a perfect guide, and I'm sure there are much better historians and analysts out there who can correct me, but it has a bit of a vibe of the Suez Crisis, which was in the 1950s, and that was the moment when Britain, a former empire, ruled the seas, reached a breaking point, weakened after World War II. The Suez was a demonstration that it could not impose its will, its foreign policy will, abroad without American support. And it was a major breaking point for British military political authority, credibility, and its alliances. And, of course, Australia shifted to the United States. This feels, I'm not saying it's a perfect comparison, but there's a bit of that to it.
Well, one of the words you used
there. The Europeans are saying no.
Yeah, that word credibility, I think, is really important. We yet to see where the dust will settle on all of this, but where does it leave the credibility of the United States when it comes to our region and China and any move on Taiwan in now or in the years to come? How credible will US positions on supporting Taiwan be taken? Does anyone seriously think that the United States would go to war, and we're talking a war of a much bigger scale, over Taiwan after really what's happened in Iran and the Strait of Hormuz?
It just now has a massive question mark on it. And I can tell you who's been taking copious notes. It's Xi Jinping.
Absolutely.
You know, like, it's every bit of the war gaming, every bit of the the game theory that underlies the way Trump operates here is being studied very, very closely. And it where are we? We've still got the same regime in charge, no matter what.
Yep.
No matter what Donald Trump says, it's not regime change. It's the same regime. And in fact, if you talk to Iranian experts, they'll tell you the guys now in charge may even be more extreme than the last lot.
Yep. You've got a question mark over the uranium stocks. You've got a question mark over the Strait of Hormuz.
And you've now got this, Iran's demonstrated this lever that it can pull to cause mayhem in economies on the other side of the world.
On the flip side, you've seen that the US under Trump does have a willingness to use its military might. It hasn't achieved all that he wanted it to achieve, but he's willing to pull the trigger. But are his threats looking a little hollow the way they continued all week, and the deadlines being pushed back and the wipe out the civilization? Yeah, it's...
Do you believe him next time?
Do you believe him next time? Mm. Where does this leave Australia?
Well, I think this is such a big debate that we sort of don't really have in this country. And I've been listening and reading with great interest to everybody who's been fulminating about how we're not prepared and we don't have enough industrial resilience, and we haven't built up our fuel stocks, and we've allowed our refining capacity to dwindle, and that we rely on global trade too much and too much short-term sort of just-in-time logistics for the way we run our economy. Well, are we going to apply the same argument to the question of our own military defence sovereignty? Or are we just going to rely on one big player who, quite frankly, is looking a little odd?
It's a fascinating question. And maybe we've got a little bit off the page of where we were intending to go today, but I love this. I think with so many industry areas, sure, you could get more fuel storage at a certain cost. Maybe, what is it, $20 billion if we were to have 90-day storage?
That's what Chris Bowen's saying. Okay. So having the full mandated amount would cost us $20 billion.
There's a certain price tag to all of these things. But in terms of defence self-reliance, boy,
We're talking $350 billion for AUKUS at the moment.
That's just the submarines.
And that's an all-in bet.
Yeah.
That's not a hedged bet. That is all chips on one number.
On one bit of kit.
Yeah.
Yeah, let alone the rest of it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it opens up that argument that people like Malcolm Turnbull have been running now for quite some time, that we are not doing our own national interest a service in terms of the sovereignty of how we secure ourselves by putting all our chips on that one particular part of the chessboard. Really interesting. I keep waiting for that debate to kick off. But at the moment, we're just kicking ourselves in the head for not having enough fuel. But what about this
other
stuff?
There's so much more. Which brings us to Matt Canavan.
Matt Canavan. Now, you know, this guy's come out of the blocks, hasn't he, since he's become leader. And I have to say, the speech that he's delivering today, quite frankly, just as we're recording this podcast, but we've all been given a little taster of it, really interesting speech. This is quite a different sounding National Party leader that I've ever heard. He does a lot of interesting reading, I would say. He's got that background in the Productivity Commission, and he's going headlong into an argument about industry policy and neoliberal economics. And he has a real crack at Milton Friedman, you know. It's quite different stuff. And I wonder what you make of it.
A couple of points. I think he is being true to himself. He's not, come to the leadership and then suddenly ditched his previous positions on this stuff and just adopted the cloak of the typical Nationals leader, the blokes that have come before him. This is true to what we know of Matt Canavan as the outspoken backbencher. He's brought much of that to the leadership. I think that's significant. I think, though, when he does talk about one of his lines, the era of free trade and liberalisation and deregulation is over. That creates a great difficulty for the Liberal Party, and a particular difficulty for...
You can feel them twitching, can't you?
Maybe not all Liberals. Andrew Hastie might be on board with some of that, but one Liberal in particular, Angus Taylor, who kind of defines that free trade, liberalisation, deregulation agenda of the Liberal Party that we've known over the last few decades, right?
I can't wait to see how this actually plays out in concrete policy or promises you take to the next election.
Indeed.
He's got other things, like he says we should actually tax the family unit as a single entity rather than both partners being taxed. Very interesting idea. It exists in other parts of the world. It's not overly radical, but it is it's a big shift in the tax system.
What about tariffs? I mean, this is one of his main messages today.
He says they're not all bad.
In particular, steel. you know, we're getting too much cheap Chinese steel, we need to have a tariff. How does the Liberal Party accommodate that? Angus Taylor, and I mentioned as I'm talking to reporters just a few minutes ago, he was asked at the end and about Matt Canavan's agenda that he's laying out today at the press club, and sort of gave a bit of a nothing answer. He said, look, yes, I agree we need an economic revolution, but he's more focused on, you know, getting inflation down as the answer to that. And yeah, he wants to see more investment in certain industries, but he's talking about private investment in industries.
It's the old prescription. Yeah. It's the old Liberal Party story. Canavan's talking about we need more babies. Yeah. We need dams and we need rocket ships.
We need government doing these things. We need government investing in these things, which, you know, is somewhat similar to, I guess, the Albanese Labor government's agenda of Future Made in Australia and having government, you know, playing a greater role in getting these future industries up and running. The difference between the Canavan worldview and the Labor worldview is, of course, energy, whereas Labor sees the renewables as the future of getting these industries off the ground. Canavan's the complete opposite.
Yeah.
And reckons coal and oil as the answer to all of our economic problems. So it comes back to this fault line that we've had for so long, haven't we, over energy in Australia?
It's not going away. No. That argument's not going away. I think Labor probably feels it has that measure. Mm. But to go back to the original discussion, this whole crisis is making us rethink energy again, even though we've set off on a particular direction. There's an argument now about whether we should get back in the business of drilling for oil in Australia. Mm. There are we did have quite a bit. We've used it all, the known reserves, but there are other opportunities if it's economically viable.
At what price is the question?
And I'm talking about the Great Australian Bite.
Yeah.
And the other one, it's interesting, the Queensland government's now pushing this project in Queensland, where there's meant to be some oil lake 3 kilometres underground, and they're wanting the federal government to speed up the environmental regs on that. Interesting debate. Canavan's behind it. The Queensland Premier's behind it. So we're back in that space. But it's a fossil fuel. It's in the Great Artesian Basin. I don't know how that plays among farmers out there. But it offers up this hope that we would have a bit more resilience in terms of liquid fuels.
Whereas Chris Bowen's answer to this global energy shock that we've been living through is we've got to accelerate towards renewables, that electrifying vehicles and homes and is the answer to making us more self-reliant. So that is going to be a fascinating debate. But just back to Canavan, I still feel like, just to underscore this point, he is heading in a very different direction to an Angus Taylor-led Liberal Party right now. Sure, they can answer a question at a press conference. It sounds like, yeah, they all agree. But you scratch the surface and there are some quite fundamental differences there.
So how do you think Angus Taylor's actually negotiating that with Matt Canavan? Have they reached some sort of settlement where they've said, look, we can go our own ways on this? My interpretation of that would be because actually they're under so much duress and threat from One Nation, they've got to go for it. Like the niceties of looking unified on some of these topics, be damned. The focus now is taking the fight, from Matt Canavan's point of view, up to One Nation fix all this stuff someday down the track.
I think on the surface, yes, it looks like, you know, Canavan, you go off and talk to that section and I'll focus on this section. To be honest, I'd love to hear a bit more from Angus Taylor about his approach to fixing the country's problems, below the sort of surface level one-liners we hear about, we've got to get inflation down. Well, great, everybody agrees with that. Yeah. When are we going to see Angus Taylor front up at the National Press Club like Matt Canavan's doing today? Give a deeper, more lengthy understanding for us all what he's on about, how he views some of these things that he's got Andrew Hastie and Canavan out there talking at great length about and offering their worldview. I just don't think we haven't yet seen from Angus Taylor that level of depth. Would you agree?
Oh, I agree with you. I think he's at risk of being the invisible man in terms of the political debate. Mm. And I don't understand why, because I think there's places he can go to make a mark, but he hasn't gone there.
He's been around for a long time. He's clearly got thoughts on all of these things.
What are they?
But, you know, now is the time to let us know. Bring us into the tent.
Yeah. Look, before we go, David, we've got to mention the fact that the Prime Minister is heading off to Singapore Thursday. Yep. He'll be there Friday. He's meeting the Singaporean Prime Minister. They did sign an agreement last week. What's this about? Is this visuals? Is this about demonstrating that we're tight, or is there actually a bit of desperation underneath it?
I think there's a few things. I think it's those. It's, you know, no doubt some substance as well of trying to make sure Singapore knows that we need to be front of the queue should these problems get worse. I think it tells us that, you know, yes, some good news with a ceasefire and hopefully free passage through the Strait of Hormuz for the next 2 weeks and maybe beyond that an end to this war. But there's no complacency. The government is still very aware that this ain't over yet, and this could still get worse. And we need to make sure that the people we buy the stuff from, Singapore, South Korea, Malaysia, know that, and that we need to be at the top of their list or near the top of their list in terms of ensuring supply. And likewise, you know, where we take more than 50% of our petrol from Singapore, and I think, what is it, 15% of diesel, 20-something percent of jet fuel, they take about a third of their LNG from Australia. So it's a two-way street. I think making that visit, Richard Marles will be in Japan. The PM spoke to China's premier yesterday as well. It shows us that these efforts within the region to talk about energy security are still very live, even though there's some better news coming out of the Strait of Hormuz.
It's so interesting, isn't it? We talked earlier in the discussion about Europe and NATO versus the Americans.
Yeah.
This is actually having an effect here in our part of the world of bringing a lot of countries together. There's a sort of unity of purpose in some of this stuff.
Well,
at least superficially, maybe we are cutting each other's throats with various deals that are being done. We don't know.
But we're talking.
But everyone's talking.
And just to square the circle on where we began, you know, you got Trump having a crack at Australia every other day and others for not, you know, helping in this war. You've got the Prime Minister here saying, well, Trump's language has been inappropriate when it comes to the threats that he's been making. They're not talking directly. They did some weeks ago about the Iranian soccer players, but I don't think they've spoken since then. And who is Anthony Albanese talking to? The region, as you say, China's premier.
We seem to think, and the Prime Minister was a bit coy about it, but the Japanese Prime Minister's headed our way,
later
it looks
month.
Like.
Yep.
So, yeah, very, very important developments. It's a Donald Trump's unifying a lot of allies around the region.
Exactly.
David, that's been great. I think I've enjoyed having this end of the microphone for once to be in control. I can see why you like it. It's all powerful.
He is unpredictable. Hands on the steering wheel. You may never let go.
Excellent. Look, thanks, that's mate. It for Politics Now today. Thanks for joining me. And Fran and PK will be back in the feed answering all of your questions on a special edition of the Party Room tomorrow. Send any of your short voice note questions for future episodes to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. See you later, David.
See ya.